Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Today I'm here with Tyler Williams, software engineer at Home Game Poker. Tyler, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And Tyler, I know this is your second appearance on the show, but for those of the listeners who have not heard you, do you want to tell us who you are?
Yeah, you said it. I am a software engineer, Home Game Poker. Our last episode was How I'd Build It, How You'd Build It, about one of my how we would build it. We collaborated. It was good. We're an online poker game. I do the full stack everything right now. It is a startup. It is actually a side project for me. I've got a day job, but I talk about that less publicly on my social media these days. So I am in other roles. I am also a full stack developer. So I'm doing software day in, day out, night in, night out.
You know, I've been playing poker with my kids recently, like last weekend and the weekend before, I think. Yeah, so it was just three of us, me and my two sons. And, like, the games don't really come to an end. Nobody wins. It's just they lose interest, and that's when we stop playing. But surprising, they really enjoy it. They are, how old are my kids? They're, like, 7 and 10.
Okay.
okay, side note. Side note to my side note, I was talking with my wife's uncle one time, and he has four kids, and he's like, yeah, the other day somebody asked me how many kids I have, and I'm like, good question. How many kids do I have? So I don't feel so bad about not knowing how old my kids are. Sure. Anyway, yeah, it's kind of surprising that they're so into poker being just 7 and 10. And we played Texas Hold'em. We kind of learned as we went. Nice. I might have asked you this last time we talked. Are you a poker player or do you just work on a poker app?
You know, I wasn't until I started on the app. There's a lot of poker in my family. My grandfather on my dad's side was a blackjack dealer, and he moved around the country to different places to work for casinos. He loved to gamble. And my parents actually got married in Las Vegas, but not like as a destination. They lived in Las Vegas, so they got married there.
I got married in Las Vegas too.
Oh, really? That's so fun. What a coincidence. Yeah. They lived there for like 3 years. Poker, card games, all sorts of casino activity is very strong in my family and my dad. I never got really into it. I played a little in college, and I have now started playing much more now that I build poker software. It started as a freelance contract and turned into a startup, which I now, am sort of employed in the way that startups employ you, right? And so I play more poker now, and it's good because I think, I was struggling initially where I was doing a lot of work that was slightly off base because I was doing a bad job of modeling poker, and so then I decided I needed to play poker to do a good job at this. And I don't know if I needed to. I could have just done a better job at requirements gathering, but my output got better once I started playing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, what we should do, Tyler, is when the pandemic is over and Ruby conferences can happen again, you and me, yeah, we should try to get together a poker game at a Ruby conference. I think that would be pretty cool.
We absolutely should. Yeah, that would be great. I'd love to. Yeah, we'll make that happen. Let's yeah, something good to look forward to. So,
yeah,
dear listeners as well, invited.
Of course. So, Tyler, today we're going to be talking about this blog post you wrote, which you called Heuristics for Object-Oriented Design in Ruby. And I took a little glance at your post, and I have some thoughts about some of it, but maybe we can just kind of go through it and talk about the stuff that's in it. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd love to. And if I could give context on why I wrote it, too, just kick us off. So I said before the show, I was rereading Sandy Metz's Practical Object-Oriented Design in Agile Primer in Ruby, Pooter. And as I was reading it, one, the title of this blog post just came across my mind. I was like, well, what if I swapped it out for heuristics? And I was like, oh, I love that. And so I was like, well, now I guess I have to write it. And I investigated why that title came into my mind. And I think it's because I've read Pooter 3 times, or this was my 3rd read through. And it's a lot, it's dense. It is a lot of information. It's a somewhat short book, and if listeners out there haven't read it, I would recommend it. You know, like I said, I've read it 3 times now. It's short. It's like 200 and something pages, but it's dense. There's a lot in there to take in. And for a long time, I have worked, I would say the bulk of my software career has been working as a solo developer. And I know that you've kind of been doing that, at least mostly recently. And I'm sure you've experienced this, where it's challenging to get a tight feedback loop on the quality of your work when you don't have managers who are looking for that. And sort of like I find myself when I've been a team of one, I hit a lot of plateaus. And so these books are great, but then I don't know what to do to apply them. So heuristics jumped into my head because I was like, you know what I really want from this book is I want a checklist. You know, Sandy writes a lot about what to do. There's a ton of code samples that are very continuous. You know, they're very good at illustrating the points, but it's like, you know, like with any code sample, it's not my work. It's not my project. And so I was like, what I really wanted was a tool that condensed this book into something that I could use as a feedback loop for myself when I'm working on my own. And so I thought of heuristics as a checklist. So at the top of the post, I kind of say, you know, here's how I intend to use it. I have been using it. Do my work, write my code, solve my problems. I step back, I step away. If I've got the space, the time to sleep on it, I sleep on it. But if it's a tighter deadline, I go make coffee or, you know, grab a drink of water and come back. And then I go through the checklist. I look at what I did. You know, I make a pull request. I look at the diff and I look at what I did and I go through this checklist. And that's what this blog post is. And we'll dig more into it. I think it's 17 steps. I pared it down. It was like 25. And I was like, that's not a heuristic. That's too much. I think even 17 is too much. And so it's split into 3 sections things that are code smells, things that you can just see if you look at an isolated file of code, things that are code organization, where you could probably see in an isolated file, but it leaks out, like maybe it's a little more about surrounding files or project structure. And then finally, abstraction considerations, which is really the modeling work. So yeah, that's how I break it out. And then once I sit back down, I go through the checklist and I do my best to hold myself to these heuristics. I also like the word heuristics here because it is not precise, right? Heuristics are sort of meant as it's sort of control flow, but the idea is it gets you close to where you're going. It's useful, but it is not meant to be like, you know, a full rule book. Like it's not a linter, right? I didn't write rules for a linter.
Yeah, it's like a guideline.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why I wrote this post. And I will say, I found through writing this post, I found that I feel like I understood Sandy Metz's work more. And through applying this post in my own work, I have felt like I've been improving more dramatically. It's hard to measure just on my own, but I that's my impression. And I should also, I threw out the blog post, I thank Sandy Metz multiple times. I am a young developer early in my career, and I respect so much the experience and knowledge of those who've come before me, and Sandy Metz, whose work I really just basically did a book report on. So, you know, if you're going to read one of our two things, I hope you read hers instead of mine.
Well, I hear people say nothing but good things about her book, and I've read it and I've found it very helpful also. So definitely, definitely helpful. But this is cool too, because it like kind of distills some of this stuff and presents it in a different way, which I think is helpful.
Yeah, I hope it's, for me, it's really an exercise of, you got a 200-page book full of good lessons. How do you hold this in your head? And I think this is the problem with a lot of programming books, is holding all the knowledge in your head. And certainly, you know, who could expect themselves to? You really have to practice and internalize these things. But yeah, I think something, a condensation, a summary, I hope that it is useful for people. If they are looking for something they can maybe hold in their heads a little clearer, I hope that a list is useful. And you know, the blog post is set up so it's the top is a little bit of context, and then it's a list. And you could stop there, I think. It's got page references in within the book. Underneath, I explain each line item. But again, if you don't have the time, I would say just look at the list. And if you if it makes sense to you, like if the words in the list are like clear things you understand, cool, you're good. Go just make a checklist for yourself, right? But if you want to dig into like what I think of these terms, or maybe you don't know some of them yourself, you know, that's where the explanations come in. So, so yeah, I hope that this sort of like bulleted list is easier to keep at the forefront of your mind as you're working. And again, in service of a tight feedback loop on the quality of your work.
Well, what do you think? Do you want to go through these things?
Let's do it. Let's see how far we can get.
All right.
Do you want to start at the top?
Sure. I see your first one is use named args to remove order dependencies.
Yeah. Yeah. So already there's a lot there. It's funny. I don't think that the ordering is necessarily like simplest to most complex or easiest to hardest. It was easiest to identify. Like if you had to say a yes, no on each of these line items, I tried to order it from what I thought was easiest to recognize. But perhaps, and the reason I'm saying that is there's just a lot in this one sentence. So Sandy Metz talks a lot about dependencies and either eliminating dependencies or managing them well. And I think that's, you know, a virtue in object-oriented programming and in many other paradigms of programming. A really straightforward dependency to identify is argument order dependencies. So if you write a method, and I think Sandy just uses like a sum method, you know, if you write a method that takes X and Y, and it sums them together and returns the sum, that's fine, right? Like that's, you can just say sum 10, 5, 10, 5, you're set. Gets a little more complex when your arguments tend to be objects. So if you've got, and so all my examples here are poker based. But if you've got, say, cards, card objects and player objects, and you have a method called deal cards, if you define it as deal cards and then just the regular Ruby arguments, cards, comma player, and you try to run like player.update, if it's an active record model, and you update their cards with the cards argument, that works fine. But all of a sudden, when people use this method, when other people or yourself in the future, you have to remember the correct order of the arguments. And that is a dependency. It's an easy one to fix by using named arguments. In Ruby, you can do that by dropping a colon at the end of your argument. So in the code sample, it doesn't look much different. It's the same thing, except it's def deal underscore cards. The first argument is cards colon, and then a comma, a space, player colon. And now you could pass player first. You could pass card first. You just specify when you use it. So there's a little extra boilerplate, but it means that it doesn't matter. You don't need to get them in the right order. And if you miss them, Ruby will actually throw an exception and tell you what you missed with the name of the argument. So I think it's a simple thing. It's easy to identify. I think, is easy to remediate. But the concepts there, it's really about, it's not about what kind of arguments are best. There are other ways to accomplish this in Ruby. It's about eliminating dependencies.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of this. My rule for myself has been like, any method that has three or more arguments should get named keywords. And yeah, even when there's just two, it can be easy to forget like which comes first. The famous like linked list thing, like every single time I create a linked list, I like do it wrong. There's a 50% chance of getting it right, and I get it wrong 100% of the time somehow. Even when I think to myself, it's like, okay, so I know that the way I have it in my head is the opposite of the real way, so I'll just flip it. Still, I get it wrong. It's
like the USB connectors, right? Like, no matter what you do, when have you seen these memes where it's like a picture of you always have to flip it three times for some reason, like because USBs are directional, and there's a history to that too. So USB-C is no longer directional, and the original inventors of the USB standard wanted it to be agnostic of which direction it was in, but it was cheaper to do it like the original way that you think of like a USB connector is. So for cost reasons, when like the original USB adapters were created, that's why we have to live in this terrible hellscape where your USB connectors are never oriented in the correct direction. Just cost cutting.
/R/first world problems.
Right. but yeah, no, I think this is, to me, it's harder to remember, especially if you've got the muscle memory of just writing your arguments. And I think what it is like when you write arguments, you specify their name, right? And so in your head, when you're writing it, you're like, well, I just said the name. I'm being specific. But you're not looking ahead to think of how will this method be called, right? Who will use it? Where will they use it? You know, this gets more and more dangerous and challenging the further away from the definition you get, either in time or in location of code.
Totally. I completely agree. Well, that seems good for the first one. Great. You want to talk about the second one here?
Yeah, sure thing. Hiding all instance variables and hide them behind methods. Ruby allows us to do that super easily. Thinking about the attribute readers and writers, the attribute accessors. So the idea here is if you've got a class, you've got an object, and it's got some data, some instance variable, never access it directly. Use some kind of method to get into it. And those like adder readers, adder writers, adder accessors, really convenient way to do it. Again, this is just a small code smell. But for me, if I see the at symbol as an instance variable inside, like, you know, more than once, I think once is reasonable. I think that in Sandy's code samples, they show you, she uses a lot of adder readers. So she sets it with the at symbol, and then she gets it from the reader method. But basically, if you see that at symbol a whole bunch in your code, consider moving your instance variables behind methods. And I think there's two things that come to mind for me on this. The first is a fundamental, one of the reasons that we do object-oriented programming, like the problem it solves is data encapsulation. This is a really great way to do data encapsulation all the way down, even in the details. So, and what I mean by that specifically is the only objects in your system that know a specific piece of data are the ones that must know it. And you have to hide it, encapsulate it from every other object. So moving away from historical problems of programs written with a ton of global state, which causes problems down the line for maintainability. The second piece of this that comes to mind is, so if you write your instance variables behind methods, you can redefine those methods later on. So like if you're grabbing a variable, say you've got a variable called bets, right? The bets on a poker table. If you use an attribute reader, so you can just access that variable the way you need to. You want to get a listing of all the bets on the table. But if you end up having to transform them in some way, or perhaps you have to sum them up, all of a sudden you can just write def bets and you can redefine that method and get it where you need to. Or if you're using some sort of hierarchy to redefine methods on subclasses, you give yourself a lot of options as your data changes. And the idea here is when you begin working on your software, you know the least amount of it as you ever will know. And so making things easy for yourself to change is the goal. And using these methods makes changes easier in the future.
Okay, so this is one that I disagree with.
Sure.
And after I say my thoughts, feel free to give me your rebuttal if you have one, or we can just agree to disagree about it.
Sure.
But my thought is that this practice doesn't add value, and it has two drawbacks in my mind. So one is that when you don't, if you were to put everything behind the Atcher reader, then like, okay, let's take this Betts example. Let's continue that. If you're referring to just Betts without the at sign, then to me, that's a little bit unclear that it's an instance variable. And so that's one thing that I don't like about it. The other thing is that if you have kind of a policy of always putting in at your reader on your instance variables so you can refer to them in this way, then that means you have an at your reader on those, meaning they are accessible from the outside and they're no longer private. So those are my two gripes with that.
Yeah, so I'm with you. I think the first one is a stylistic preference, and agree to disagree. I have no strong rebuttal for you there. I think at the end of the day, do what you like. The second one is really good. It actually gets to a later one, a later item on this list, which is to have clearly defined public interfaces. And part of that is being really intentional about what you expose as a public method on a class or an object. And so, yeah, I'm with you. If you've got some instance variable that you don't want used in that way, then yes. But I would say, and again, I agree with you overall. I think that question that comes up is, you know, makes me wonder why is it an instance variable, right? Like maybe there's a way around this where you can really say my instance variables are meant to be public. Like I only do, and this requires, I think that's a philosophical shift, right? I don't know if that's good or bad, but if you were looking to like follow this rule specifically, I think there are ways you could structure your code to say that like instance variables are things I intend to be read from, or perhaps written to, maybe, but at least read from. And anything I need privately gets defined privately. And I write my methods, my private methods, such that they don't need to share a ton of scope, right? But that's not, I'm with you. Yeah, that's just like what I might do to resolve that concern if I was strictly following this heuristic, which is not meant to be strictly followed.
So that's my thoughts. That's Tyler's thoughts. Should we move on to the next item?
Yeah, sure thing. I also want to stop us too. And so there's 17 of these. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm just wondering about time. And I'd love to.
We can
to,
jump around to, if you want.
Yeah, I'd love to jump around because we're talking about these sort of like nitty gritty in the weeds code smells. And we've already touched on these other pieces that go to code organization and abstraction considerations. And I'd like to just jump down to code organization because it's related to what we were talking about just now, which is create intentionally designed public interfaces.
Okay. Yeah, tell us about this one.
So a lot of software writers or authors who write about good software, best practices, right? Not just software authors and developers and coders. I think like thought leaders here, and basically, you know, to get to the point, Sandy Metz says, one of the most important things that we're doing with code here is like it's not that we're telling the computer what to do, it's that we're telling other like developers, even ourselves at a different time and point in time, telling other people how to use this code. And so when we write, so in Ruby, when you're writing a class definition and you're defining methods, you can use the private keyword to define private methods. And so the idea is, you know, those methods can only be called by the instance of that class. So a public method might say like, you know, call it like a greeting. So say you've got a person class and you define like def greeting, say hello, you know, print hello, right? Anyone can use that, like, hey, greeting. But then maybe under the private keyword, you literally type private, and underneath you define like bank password, right? Like that person needs to know their bank password, but it's not something that they should respond to from other people in the world, other than perhaps a bank teller. But anyway, they can use that method to do their bank password, but no one else will be able to call it, right? And so the idea here is, when you use the private keyword, you are making a very explicit choice about what methods your class will respond to from other objects. And that's important because not so much for the software of it all. Sure, that's important. I think as Rubyists, I think that a Java developer might feel more strongly that that's important at a computer, at a hardware level. I think Rubyists, where we're not so statically defined, I think we probably care less about that. But from a communication standpoint, really what you're saying is anything that I've defined before the private keyword are methods I expect you, other developer, to use, right? And then anything under private is stuff that you shouldn't rely on. And that's what Sandy Match kind of says, that is like, it's this dependency management thing, is that private methods are, it's a way to indicate, hey, this stuff is not necessarily stable. You should not call this elsewhere. We really only want to use it here. And you can use private methods in your public methods, right? So your public methods can rely on those private methods. But again, that sort of dependency is isolated to the class. Whereas if other objects in your code base were using these private methods and then something changed all of a sudden, you've got a lot of problems spread throughout your code base.
I'll share how I think about private methods. And I really didn't understand the purpose of private methods for a long time, but
right.
here's my current conception, and I'll pat myself on the back because I feel like I've come up with like a one sentence definition of or explanation of private methods that really captures it, which is the purpose of private methods is to show what can safely be refactored.
Yeah.
So anything above that private line, that is not safe to refactor.
Right.
Because other objects might be using those methods. But anything that's below that private line, you have more or less a guarantee, and I know there's ways around it with the yes. send method, but you basically have a guarantee that that stuff isn't being called from anywhere outside, and so you can safely refactor away. And to me, that's the value in private methods.
Yeah.
And I want to be clear that it's not about security. It's not something to do with security. It's just for code organization.
Yeah, and that's kind of how that context I started with about this communication piece between people. That's precisely it. It's like the private keyword, and especially in Ruby, where, like you said, there are ways to get around where you can actually call private methods. The private keyword, to me, and I think to you, and so I agree with your definition here, it is a communication standard. If you're reading my code and you see private, you now understand, like you said, you can refactor those methods because it is highly unlikely that anything other than this file is relying on them. And if it is, it's made a conscious choice to rely on something unstable, right? If it's tried to circumvent that, it's made a choice.
And I'll inject a little side note here. A common question is how should you test private methods, or should you test private methods? And my answer is yes, you should test private methods, but not directly. So you wouldn't write a test that like refers to the name of the private method itself. You would test the behavior of the private method, but only indirectly through the public interface that references that private method.
Yeah, and that's I'm glad you said that clarifying point, because I think in Pooter, in Sandy's original work, she like says don't test private methods. She has a chapter on testing. And I don't remember, it's been a little while since I wrote this post and reread the book. I can't remember if she makes the distinction about testing the behavior. I'm sure she does in some way, but I think it would be easy for someone to read it and walk away thinking that private methods are things that also never need to be tested. And like, that's not the case. Like, you should still, because if you were to do like a code coverage thing, you would still want like your private methods to end up in the execution path, right? You would want to execute as many of those methods as possible through your testing. But like you said, it's about the behavior and not necessarily testing the signature of the method. Like, does this respond to these arguments? It's like, no, like, does the public method that we know relies on the private methods, does that work predictably? And like you said, it's part of refactoring.
And if you get to the point where you have tests that cover all of your private methods and you've made that distinction of here's what's private, here's what's public, then you can really go nuts with your refactoring, because you know that you can't break, well, you know, you don't know, but you have a pretty high level of confidence that you won't break anything by refactoring that stuff. And that's what gives you the freedom to make your code really nice and understandable.
Yeah. Or that you can break it and you'll know you've broken it.
Yeah. I want to be careful about like knowledge versus confidence, because like,
right,
no amount of tests will give you knowledge that you can't break anything. All it can give you is a really high degree of confidence, which is still really good. It's just not exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think that's an interesting distinction. And that's something that, gosh, I don't know. I don't know anything about scientific research, so I won't say much about it. I have heard the term of like confidence intervals, right? And so I think that's interesting, right? Is this idea that like there is a difference between, or that there are two different things. There are conclusions from research, and there is confidence about research. And so I will stop saying things about that because I don't know anything else about it. But I think that's a similar idea.
Well, I come at it from a philosophy standpoint. And like, I wrote a couple blog posts about philosophy and programming. And like,
I remember,
nobody but me on earth gives a shit about this stuff, but I think it's super interesting.
I'm here with you.
Okay, great. Finally, the first person I've found who wants to talk about this stuff.
And to like expand too for listeners, this isn't just me begging Jason for a third appearance. I mean it. I have an interdisciplinary background in software and computer science. I actually have a BA in history. Although I studied computer science in college for 3 years, and I'm currently getting my master's in software engineering. So I have formal education, but not complete. And my actual complete degree is in history. And I've spoken with Noah Gibbs about this a little bit. I think much of the work I did in history, especially in historiography, which is the art of doing history, right? It's not the history itself, but it is how do you write about history. I find that is very relevant to how you write software. So,
We're gonna have to talk about that.
Okay, let's do it. See, okay, so I got my third episode, just as I was angling for. But no, philosophy as well. I care about interdisciplinary approaches to software because I think that it matters. I think it matters in a real world value way, and it's also just interesting.
Yeah, well, there's this branch of philosophy called epistemology, as I'm sure you know, Tyler, which is basically how do we know what's true and not true.
Right.
And then like, you know, you can talk about like knowledge versus, I'm really drawing a blank here. I'll have to go and read my own blog post.
Sure. Yeah. Knowledge, but there was something in your blog post. I recall this now. We were just talking about confidence, but I think it was something else.
I'm going to go and Google this right now because I'm curious, what did I even write about back then that had to do with philosophy? Okay, philosophy archives, codewithjason.com. Okay, yeah, here's what I talked about. I talked about logical arguments. And so I think I touched a little bit on logical fallacies and stuff like that. And we'll have to get into this another time because I'm like super rusty on all this stuff. But I think all that stuff is super relevant to programming because like, okay, when you're debugging things, here's when like knowledge versus not knowledge comes into the picture very sharply is like you have a bug in your program and you don't know why it's there. And so your job now is to like go and collect facts. But it's not always easy because like you go and do a piece of investigation and you find out that something is maybe true, but there's like a weight to the truthfulness of each thing that you discover. Like either you know it for an absolute hard fact, or you're like 90% sure that this is probably true, or it's like, right, maybe this is true, maybe it's not. And I think people a lot of the times, including myself, we fool ourselves. We get a piece of information and we accept it as a truth, but it's not actually a truth. And so then we draw invalid conclusions, because all true conclusions must start with true premises. And if any part of our premise isn't true, then our conclusion is not necessarily true.
Right. And it's funny, you know, this is, I think, the intersection of, you're talking about philosophy, but that's also how formal mathematical proofs work as well. Right. And these things are so intrinsically linked.
Yeah. Well, math is philosophy.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And like what we consider to be mathematically correct, the axioms there come from philosophical assumptions that we make along the way and that we've agreed on as a society. And in many ways we haven't actually agreed, but you know, we, like the two of us and perhaps many of the listeners, are operating in a context, in a shared context of agreed mathematical axioms. But there are people out there in the world who have a different fundamental starting point for their mathematical axioms.
And you know what? Programming was originally conceived as a branch of math, and math was originally conceived as a branch of philosophy. So,
and here we are.
Programming is philosophy.
And now we are pontificating on private keywords, the use of adder accessors, right? And that's, you know, and I think to like get back to sort of like where we started and like why that matters and why this matters, you know, these are heuristics and they are not, like they're not 100%. My confidence on each one of these is not 100%. These are places to start and things to think about. They're questions to wrestle with. Some of them are perhaps clearer to read, clearer to identify than others. And I can, let's juxtapose it a little bit with some of these abstraction considerations.
I want to jump in and comment on something you said. I think part of this has to do with, like you said, like confidence and stuff like that. I think part of this has to do with the fact that programming is part science and part art.
Yeah.
And it's arguably more art than it is science. And like the things like code organization, these are reasons why people have these holy wars in programming and stuff like that, because you can't say what's right and what's wrong with absolute certainty, because there's not like, there's not a way to tell what is empirically better or worse. And so this is where the art comes into the picture. And like, I can say that I think it's better to use private methods and have some tests that exercise my private methods via my public methods. And another person could say, tests are stupid, private methods are worthless, and I don't use any of that stuff. And I can say, well, I think you're wrong, but I can't prove that he's wrong.
Yeah, and you could even come up with metrics to try and prove them wrong or prove yourself right. But then, you know, the metrics you come up with have to fall under question as well of whether or not those matter. So like you can get closer, and like you said, a higher degree of confidence, right? Is like, and this is a lot like testing your software. You can write any number of tests and you can have tests pass, but your degree of confidence on what that passing or failure means, like that's what's important in the testing, right? Is like how, like, and like you said, I think this stemmed from a comment about like whether or not you know something, right? Versus are you confident about something working? And it really is, yeah, like when you're testing things, you're testing confidence, or you're providing yourself with confidence based around some assumptions.
Yeah, and these methodologies are really hard to prove empirically because it's really hard to study. Because it's like you can't compare apples to apples, one organization versus another organization. And you can't compare one programmer versus another programmer because everything they do is so mixed up with all these unrelated things that vary so much from case to case.
Yeah, it's hard. And I think if I can, too, just use that to transition to these abstraction considerations. I want to start with, like, let's start with, I think this one is the most interesting one to me because it is the strictest and perhaps the hardest. And it's just the first one. It's number 11 in my list. And, you know, almost entirely taken from Sandy Metz, which is every class should have a one sentence description and you are not allowed to use conjunctions in that sentence. And this gets to the single responsibility principle, which is the S in the acronym SOLID, which is a classic set of software engineering patterns by the Gang of Four. So these are things that you might learn in a traditional computer science course. If you haven't, they're worth your time Googling and reading. And they've informed a lot of the work people have done later on, including Sandy Metz's books. So every class to follow the single responsibility principle, which is everything does one thing, has one responsibility. And I think, you know, sort of like to rephrase that into like Sandy Metz's words here is that you'll know if your classes follow the single responsibility principle if you can describe them with one sentence and not use conjunctions.
This is interesting because I've never tried to describe a class.
Interesting. Have you? What have you done? Do you do a lot of documentation? I love documentation. Even on projects, even on solo projects, I'm sure people have gotten it. I'm a chatty kind of person. And so when I'm working alone and I have no one to talk to, I talk to my documentation. And so I have described classes. I usually do. I try to do sort of the, I do a little bit of test-driven development, TDD. I try and do a little bit of documentation-driven development, which is interesting. It's a little squishier sometimes, but I find it useful. And one of the things I find useful, like almost ubiquitously, is before I write the class, I just open up a little markdown file, and the header of the markdown file is the class name, and then I write one sentence. I say, I'm writing a class to do that, and I use different words, but like basically I say, this is what this class does. And ideally, I could get it to one sentence with no conjunctions. I think that's rare. And that's why, like I said, this is squishier. It's harder. Like, if you want to follow it strictly, it's really challenging. But I think that this is where that philosophy comes into it, because what is one thing, right? Like, I've got a Rails app for this poker game. One sentence. The home game poker Ruby on Rails app allows people to play poker with their friends. That's one sentence with no conjunctions, but boy oh boy, does it do a lot more than that, right? And it glosses, there's like hand waving there, because that's what it does as a description, but that is not it is not accurate to the technical thing that it does, right? Because really, it responds to HTTP requests, it opens WebSockets, it compiles and bundles JavaScript and React so that there's a user interface. Like, that's what I really mean. And if I were to write it that way, one sentence would be hard. So it gets, you know, I think it's easier when you're looking at singular classes, right? But even then, it's tricky. And it's tricky to know how faithful you're, and I think this is that sort of confidence thing, because sure, you could use one single sentence for everything, but the more you have to gloss over it, I think the further you're getting away from the spirit of this.
Yeah, I've always been dubious of the value of the single responsibility principle, because I think you're spot on in saying, what is one thing? And I've thought of that myself. Like, what exactly does it mean for a class to do one thing? Because no class just does one thing. Yeah. Every class does a number of things.
If you think about it from a compilation standpoint, right? If you're thinking, I'm reading through Ruby under a microscope right now, which like steps through the Ruby virtual machine and like shows you a bunch of like the actual like machine instructions that happen per thing. It's really cool. Totally recommend it. It's a little outdated. It's before, I think it's like Ruby 2.4 or something like that, maybe even earlier. But the principles there are sound. And what I'm getting at is, if you've got a class that like has an instance variable, like a string, like a name, and it like prints out that string, does two things, right? Like, if you compile that class, it's got to remember the string, its instance variable, and it's got to print it out. There's your conjunction, right? Like, okay, is it like, did we violate the single responsibility principle? I don't think so. And that's where it gets philosophical, is because, well, what I mean is, this person class, it has a name, and it has a function to print out that name. But the sentence I would say is, the person class represents one human person's name.
Yeah, you know what? So here's like a little bit of, I felt like not completely comfortable with this question of like, can I describe what this class does in one sentence without using any conjunctions? I don't think of classes as doing things. I think of classes as being things.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair. It's like so are you getting at the purpose of the class?
Maybe. And something else that's maybe interesting to talk about and relevant is like talking about how classes come into existence. I find it interesting what you described, like you'll write something in a document about what a class might be before you create that class. Because the way that my classes come into existence is a different way, it sounds like, which is this. So like usually I'll start off with a small number of course grand classes early on in the life of an application. Like for this EMR that I've been building, I of course have patients, I have appointments, I have physicians, very coarse grained objects. And then right. As the application grows, I start to have things like, let me look real quick at some of these items here. Oh yeah, here's one. A benefits investigation analysis. So like that's a fine-grained one. And so when those finer-grained objects arise, they usually arise out of like, I'll have my coarse-grained objects and I'll have the behaviors associated with them. Eventually they'll get like too big and do too much stuff. And so I'll start to extract items out of there. And basically like, let's say that I have 10 methods on a class and two of those 10 methods seem not quite apples to apples to the other eight of the methods. And so I'll look at those two methods and say, is there a missing abstraction here? That's like a term that I think of a lot, missing abstraction. Right. Is there something that exists that I just haven't named yet? And so I'll look at that and be like, oh yeah, this concept here, this is a benefits investigation analysis. That's what's happening. So I'll take out those methods and put them in a new class called benefits investigation analysis. So that's kind of how my classes tend to come to be.
Sure. Yeah. And you know, I'll be very honest, like that has been a lot of the work that I've done making classes, like the exact same process. It's only recently that I've tried to instill my own restriction or like limitation or requirement that I open up a markdown file before I type the word class benefits analysis investigation. And it's hard. It's hard to do consistently. It doesn't always feel useful, and perhaps it is not always useful. I really don't know yet. I think this is one of those things that I will know, I will have a stronger opinion about after a few years of working on the project in which I did this. Right. It's like, and it's tough. It's a gamble. The nice thing is I do this on sort of like my side project stuff more than I do at my day job. At my day job, I take cues from our standard processes so that I know someone else has an opinion about it. But when it comes to my side stuff, it's a risk that I'm doing something that is a waste of time. And it's risky because I don't know if I can evaluate that until I find out whether or not I have wasted my time. You know, this thing about the question and what is a purpose, or does a class do something, or is it something? I think it also just like ties up in these abstraction considerations the next two points, which are 12 and 13, where it's basically a continuation. Is if you rephrase your class methods as questions to the object, each question should make sense. It should be related to the purpose of the class. Those are Sandy's words, not mine. And that's the sort of thing, is like that one sentence description. I think you're right. I don't think it is, this is what the class does. I think it is, what is the purpose of this class? Because the methods are what it does. And then the next piece, sorry to chain these one after another, but they're so related, is that messages, which is a stand-in for methods. Sandy talks a lot about how like object-oriented programming is about messages, not about objects. So yeah. These messages, or method calls, they should ask for what instead of dictating how. So again, it's not about how you do something, how an object gives you an answer. It is that the object provides you with an answer to your method call, and your method call should be related to the purpose of that object, which, again, to roll right back up, should be a one-sentence description, a one-sentence purpose, no conjunctions. So I don't know if that makes that easier. To go back to your sort of initial reluctance thinking about one sentence, no conjunctions, if you think about it as a purpose, does that change things for you?
I'm not sure. What you said about the messages, that's something that I agree with big time. Because I do agree that it makes a lot more sense to think of, like, the essence of a class is more about the class's methods than the class's name. Because what is the class other than the methods it's made up of?
Yeah, or even the instance variables, right? Because, again, I think you should – I personally, this is not from the book. I think you should have as few instance variables as possible. I try to do that. But yeah, I'm with you. But like, so in that same way, it's like I hope to write classes that are not defined by their data, because I hope that they have very little of it to be defined by. But more methods, that's fine. You know, I'd rather have – I would almost always rather have more methods than instance variables. If I've done that, I feel pretty good about where I'm at.
Hmm. Yeah, I have no opinion on that. I'm looking at some of my classes here. I'm looking at one class because I wanted to explore the question of, like, okay, so what did this say? If you rephrase your class methods as questions to the object, each question should make sense. Okay, so I have this birthdate class, and that's because it's surprisingly non-trivial to figure out how old somebody is based on their birthdate, mostly because of leap years. And so I have this birthdate class, and the it has two instance variables. One is the date itself, birthdate, and then the other is called now, and I'm setting it to today's date. Interesting. I wonder why that is.
Is it just time.now, or do you set a time zone on it? How are you doing? That scares me.
Well, it's time.now.utc.todate.
Okay. There we go. Cool. Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
And then it only has one public method, which is time ago in years.
Sure. That gives you the age.
Yeah. And so...
So if I asked... Mm-hmm. If I asked a birth... So to, like, rephrase it, right? So time ago in age is... You're asking the birth date, or time ago in years. You're asking the birth date. How many years ago are you, or did you happen? Right. That makes sense. That feels related based on the thing you're trying to solve here, which I think, to rephrase what you said, is make it easier to calculate people's age.
Yeah. Next time I want to know how old somebody is, I'm going to ask them, how many years ago are you? And then wait for their response.
Yeah. That's great. That tracks. I feel like, and so, you know, and again, this is, if I was using this checklist, this heuristics against that class, that's precisely an example of how I would use these heuristics. I'd look at, like, just like you did, you pulled open the class, you looked at it, you read the public method, and we tried to rephrase it. We thought about, why did you write this class in the first place? And it tracks. But again, this is, and that's why I bucket these out. Because we had to talk about it, we had to think about it, and look, you know, I think this is a little more clear cut, but I think in many, many examples of this sort of process is much more subjective, whereas this first bucket of code smells, you know, you can look at a method and say, and, you know, are they named arguments or not, right? And that's a yes or no answer. And there's philosophy behind what's better to use or not, but it is easier to identify, quicker to remediate or make a decision about. Whereas these more abstract ones, I think they, you know, they have you pause a little bit. And the idea is that you use the straightforward ones to inform yourself about. If you get through all the straightforward ones and everything's green, you know, maybe think about some of the abstraction stuff, but honestly, I would just say, cool, great, we're good. But if you've got some, like, if you find yourself walking through the code smells and the code organization, and you've had to wrestle with a little bit of it, instead of resolving those immediately, I would jump to the abstraction thing. And you said that missing abstraction. Perhaps you've missed an abstraction, or perhaps the way you've modeled your abstraction is not useful and could be done better. And then you think about these other heuristics, which is the one sentence description, the questions as methods, asking what instead of dictating how, and that sort of stuff. So that's kind of, I feel like we've done a really good job of running the gamut of like this blog post and this thing that I'm personally trying, because like I said, I'm using this in my day-to-day work and I'm trying to use it to become a better person who writes software or better at writing software.
And one more thing maybe before we wrap up is, could we talk a little bit more about this ask for what instead of dictating how? Because I think that's a really important one. And this is one that I completely agree with, because like it gives me pause, or it gives me, it makes me unhappy when I see a method that like dictates exactly what to do. Mm-hmm. Because like a program that dictates low level steps of things to do, it's made up of method calls that say do such and such thing to this other thing. I think that's much more difficult to maintain than a program with methods that ask for things and are more like high level.
That is, I think that's the essence of Sandy Metz's point. It's the essence that I kind of got out of it. And it really is that like, and in so many ways, I think it's reflected in this sort of public and private interfaces, is that you're really asking for what is the publicly available information. So you want to ask what, right? You want to say, again, how many years ago are you, right? But you don't want to say, you don't want to have, so say if you've got an object that's interacting with that birthday class, you've got a greeting card object, and it's asking the birthday class because it wants to say congrats on 27 years, right? You don't want your greeting card class to say birthday, like tell me your birth date. Find out what, you know, doing all the stuff that the birthday class does itself. You don't want to say, give me the date, give me today's date, subtract them, look at the year, calculate leap years. You don't want the greeting card to do that, because why is a greeting card doing that? The only thing a greeting card needs to know in this case from the birth date class is, what number do I put on the card? And so it should ask the birth date what number to do that with. It shouldn't tell it how to figure it out. It should just trust that privately the birth date object will do the thing.
Here's another example that's maybe a good one. I have this part in my application that will, okay, so every time a patient has an appointment, they get billed for it. And so we need to like keep track of which procedures were done. And there's like all these billing codes for these various procedures and stuff. And we take those codes and then we download them into this specially formatted file. And then we send that file off to a clearinghouse, and that clearinghouse acts as kind of like a liaison between us and the insurance companies, and then the insurance companies send in the payments.
Right.
So the act of creating this specially formatted file, and it's like, it's not like a CSV or anything, it's this like, it's this awful proprietary pipe delimited file that's, it's really totally wacky. But anyway, the generation of this file is pretty complicated. And so I could easily, and the programmer of me of some years ago probably would have seen this as a procedural job where I start at step one and I say, okay, get all these billing codes and then format this way and then blah, blah, blah. But instead, I have this object that represents the file, and then I have these lower level objects, like, okay, I have something called a charge slot, and so for each charge it gets like slotted into a spot in this file, and there's certain information about this charge that needs to appear, like the date of service, procedure code modifier, units, etc. There's just several things like that. And so I have this charge slot object. And when I initialize it, I just give it an array of charges. I give it an offset. I don't remember what the offset is, but it gets an offset. And then I have just a few methods on it. Kind of the main method on this object is called value. And that just returns a hash containing those aforementioned attributes, date of service, blah, blah, blah. And then there's a few others. One is diagnosis code index. Don't remember what that is. And then a couple other ones like that. So this isn't a... I'm not saying to this charge slot, like, do these specific things. I'm just saying, give me your value. That's a pretty vague method name, value. But that's good because all that the client method needs to worry about, or the client object or whatever, is it says, make me a new charge slot and then do charge slot dot value. And that's great because then the human reading that doesn't have to worry about how the value is conjured up. You just say, okay, this charge slot has a value. I can understand what a charge slot is. I can understand what it means for the charge slot to have a value. And that is all I need to know at this level of abstraction. And if I care about the details, I can go into that object and find out.
Right. And if things change, it's, again, understandable to change, right? Like, you can sort of change that interface and make it clear. Or if, you know, if you were doing it more procedurally and say, for some reason, say, so in your value, the return of the value, you've got a hash, right? And say you didn't have that hash and you just returned like one string or something, it would become much harder to say, to isolate one piece of the procedure that you've come up with, right? But here you've got this, you have a surface area where, one, I think you've got some granular data available, but two, if there isn't, and you find out that more granular data is required, and again, this is back to the whole reason for this blog post. Like, when I said before I want to become better at writing software, what I mean is I want my software to be easier to change for myself and the people I work with, because that drives business value, because developer time is expensive. So the less of it you can spend to get what you need, the more your business gets out of you and your value. So again, if you needed more granular data in this charge slot, and it's easier for you to provide that because you just extend the hash to have a new key. Cool. Like, much better than having to go dig into the internal implementation of like, okay, wait, where do I calculate that charge? Oh, before I calculate it, I actually need to get the number in cents, right? I need to get this dollar number in cents first, right? Which maybe you're doing procedurally, but you give yourself surface area to make that change quickly and easily and understandably for both you in the future. And hey, you got two new coworkers that have to read your stuff now, man.
Yeah. Yeah. This would be a great test to see how understandable the code actually is. These are genuine, fresh people who aren't me. Can they actually understand the code?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Tyler, this has been great. This has been enjoyable. I've learned some things in this conversation. I've had some enjoyable debate, on these items where we see it differently. And then obviously there's a lot of stuff we agreed about too. Where should people go to find more about you online?
The best place right now is homegamepoker.com. One word, all spelled correctly. Homegamepoker. And you can see, I think you can go see for yourself, or you can evaluate for yourself whether or not you think I have become a better software engineer through this kind of study, because it's all, so it's Ruby on Rails, React on the front end, and a lot of the lifting, all the poker logic is written in Ruby. So if you got, you know, questions or feedback on it, let's see if my approach here has made my Ruby code better.
Well, Tyler, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.